thought conjured an old memory of my father sitting on my bed and showing me the back of a magazine, where two drawings were printed that looked identical. It was asking the reader to figure out the difference between them. "This is a trick question," I'd remembered declaring to him with crossed arms. My eyes squinted closely at every corner of both images. "The two drawings are exactly the same." Dad just gave me a crooked smile and adjusted his glasses. There was still paint and glue stuck in his hair from when he was experimenting with fabrics earlier in the day. I'd need to help him cut the sticky strands out later. "Look closer," he'd replied. He'd grabbed the pencil tucked behind his ear and made a sweeping motion across the image. "Think about a painting hanging on a wall. Without using any tools, you can still tell if it's crooked, even by a tiny bit. It just feels off, right?" I'd shrugged. "Yeah, I guess so." "Humans are surprisingly sensitive like that." Dad had gestured at the two drawings again with his paint-stained fingers. "You have to learn to look at the whole of something, not just the parts. Relax your eyes. Take in the entire image at once." I'd listened, sitting back and softening my gaze. That had been when I'd finally spotted the difference, the tiny mark on one of the drawings. "There," I'd exclaimed, pointing excitedly at it. Dad had smiled at me. "See," he'd said, "every locked door has a key, Emmy." I stared down at the assignment, my father's words turning over and over in my mind. Then I did as he said. I leaned back and took in the code all at once, like it was a painting, like I was searching for the point of interest. And almost immediately, I saw the error. I reached for my school laptop, opened it, and typed out the corrected code. It worked. "Hello, world," said my laptop's program. To this day, I can't properly describe how I felt in that moment. To see my solution working, functioning on the screen. To realize that with three little lines of text, I had the power to command a machine to do exactly what I wanted. The gears in my head, creaky from grief, suddenly began to turn again, begging for another problem. I finished the second one, then a third. I kept going, faster and faster, until I finished not only that homework sheet, but every problem in my textbook. The fog in my chest eased, revealing a warm, beating heart beneath it. If I could solve these problems, then I could control something. And if I could control something, I could forgive myself for the one problem that I could never have solved. The one person I could never have saved. Everyone has a different way of escaping the dark stillness of their mind. This, I learned, was mine. I finished my dinner that night for the first time in months. The next day, and the day after that, and every day since, I channeled every bit of my energy into learning everything about code and Warcross and the Neuralink that I could get my brains on. As for Hideo Tanaka, from that day on, along with the rest of the world, I was obsessed. I watched him as if I were afraid to blink, incapable of looking away, like he might start another revolution at any moment. Chapter 4. My glasses are old and used, several generations behind, but they work fine. I put them on and the earphones fit snugly, sealing out the sound of outside traffic and footsteps from upstairs. Our humble apartment, and with it all my worries, is replaced by blackness and silence. I exhale, relieved to leave the real world behind for a while. My view soon fills with a neon blue light, and I find myself standing on the top of a hill, looking down at the city lights of a virtual Tokyo that could pass for the real thing. The only reminder that I'm inside a simulation is a clear box hovering in the center of my vision. Welcome back, bracket, null, bracket. Level 24, 430 notes. Those two lines then vanish. Bracket, null, bracket, of course, isn't exactly my name. In my hacked account, I'm able to wander around as an anonymous player. Other players crossing my path will see me as a randomly generated username. When I look behind me, I see my customized room decked out in variations of the Warcross logo. Normally, this room has two doors: play around or watch other people play. Today, though, there is a third door, above which some text hovers. Warcross Opening Ceremony Game. Live. In real life, I tap my fingers against the tabletop. As I do, the glasses sense my finger movements, and a virtual keyboard slides out. I search for Kira in the player directory. I find her in no time, connect with her, and a few seconds later, she accepts my invite and appears at my side. Like me, and most other players, she's designed her avatar to look like an idealized version of her real self, adorned with a few cool game items, a gleaming breastplate, a pair of horns she'd bought. "Let's head in," she says. I move forward, then reach my hand out and open the third door. Light washes over me. I squint, and my heart gives a familiar leap as the invisible roar of viewers drowns out everything. A soundtrack swells over my earphones. I find myself standing on one of what seems like a million floating islands, staring down into the most beautiful valley I've ever seen. A wide expanse of lush plains turns into a crystal blue lagoon, surrounded by towering cliffs and smooth, steep rocks, their tops covered with vegetation. Waterfalls thunder down their sides. When I look closer, I realize that the rocks are actually enormous sculptures, each of them carved to look like past tournament winners. Rays of sun dance through the valley, painting light on the plains, even as the floating isles cast patches of shadows. Flocks of white birds cry out in formation below us. The towers of a castle on the cliffs peek through the distant mist. Farther, to the horizon, majestic ocean ray-like creatures glide in the air. There, the sky is black, and lightning forks between the clouds. I shiver as if I could sense the electricity in the air. Even the soundtrack chosen for this level is off the charts epic, full of orchestral strings and deep drums, sending my heart soaring. Above it all, a grand voice echoes across the world. "Welcome to the Warcross Opening Ceremony Game." A soft ding sounds, and a transparent bubble pops up in the middle of my view. Logged into Opening Ceremony. Plus 150 points. Daily score, plus 150. Level 24, 580 notes. Then it fades away. My reward for watching the opening game is 150 points, which will go toward my leveling. Except, it won't, since I've hacked this version of Warcross. Too bad. If I played like a normal person, I'd probably be at level 90 or so by now, but I'm still at level 24. "They always do it up, don't they?" Kira's voice makes me blink. She has a look of wonder on her face. I smile, then take a deep breath and spread my arms out. I leap off my floating aisle, and I fly. My stomach drops as my brain believes I'm actually thousands of feet in the air. I let out a whoop as I soar over the plain, the music egging me on. There are restrictions on the official competing players. Some worlds allow players to fly around or swim underwater, while others must obey virtual gravity. But audience members are always free to wander around the landscape however they wish. We're barred from altering it in any way or interfering with the players. The players won't see us either. They can only hear the roar of our cheers or boos, as well as the referee's calls. I fly straight through the floating aisles like a ghost, angling up to go as high as I can until I can't get any farther from land. Then I turn around and dive back down like a meteor. I finally stop on one of the floating aisles, right as the cheers of the audience mix with the voices of the game analysts coming from my earphones, as if I were listening to them on a radio. "It's time for the annual opening ceremony game," one of them exclaims. "We've gathered here tonight to watch this all-star performance before the real tournament season begins. At the far end, we have Team Alpha, led by Asher Wing. At the near end, we have Team Beta, led by Penn Wachowski." The players finally appear, scattered at opposite ends of the mass of floating islands. I fly away from Kira and head over to see them more closely. The Avatar rule for official professional Warcross players is that their virtual selves must look like their real selves, without any of the crazy customizations typical users can have, and that each team's members must wear the same color. Team Alpha's color is blue. There's Jenna, all blonde hair and lanky limbs in her blue-fitted Warcross armor, its dragon scale texture tailored to match the level. She's one of the younger players, only 18, same as me, and is from Ireland. As I watch her, she tosses her hair over her shoulders and places her hands on her hips. Her silver arm guards gleam in the sun, as do the identical knives strapped to her thighs. The audience screams their approval. Standing on a floating island nearby is Max. Max, the son of millionaires, is a Harvard grad. His Warcross position is a fighter, for sheer brawn and power, with the goal of taking others down instead of hunting for the artifact. At 28, he's the oldest player in this year's tournaments. His shoulder armor is enormous and hulking, so shiny that it reflects the sky and contrasts sharply against his dark skin. Then there's Asher, the team's captain, who is the farthest from where I'm floating. Originally known only as the younger brother of Daniel Batu Wing, an actor and stuntman, Asher's now famous in his own right because of Warcross. He has thick brown hair so light that it's almost blonde, and his eyes are a playful blue, the same color as the virtual lagoon below him. His deep sapphire armor is finished with steel shoulder plates and leather straps along his arms and waist. He grins cheekily, crosses his arms against his chest, and calls out a challenge to the other team at the opposite end of the game world, which makes the audience go wild. When I toggle my view to show the audience in the Tokyo Dome, they are shrieking his name and waving glowing batons frantically. "Marry me, Asher," scream the fan posters. Asher says something through his secure line, words only his teammates can hear. Over his head floats a shimmering blue gem. This is his team's artifact. The game announcer has started the official pre-game ritual, reading off something about good sportsmanship and honorable gameplay. As she goes on, my attention shifts to Team Beta. They're decked out in red armor, of course. The annual opening game always color-codes the teams red versus blue. Penn, the Beta captain, has a sparkling red artifact hovering over his head. He and Asher smirk at each other, and the shouts from the audience go up an octave. Over my earphones, the announcer finishes her speech with a now-standard reminder of what the objective is, for the benefit of any new audience members who are watching. "Remember, teams, you have only one goal. Take your enemy team's artifact before they can take yours." The players each raise their right fist. They hit them twice against their chests, the standard response to acknowledging the rules. There is a brief pause, as if everything in the level had suddenly frozen. "Game," the announcer shouts. The crowd chants along. "Set. Fight." The world trembles from the roar of the invisible audience, and the clouds in the sky start to move rapidly. The storm that blackens the horizon is sweeping toward us at a frightening pace, its lightning forking closer with each passing second. As with every Warcross world, the game gets harder the longer it goes on. At the same time, brightly colored marbles appear, hovering over many of the aisles. These items are power-ups, temporary bursts of super speed, wings to help you fly for short periods, shields of defense that can stop an enemy attack, and so on. There are dozens of different power-ups that can potentially appear in a game, and new ones are added all the time. Low-level power-ups, like something that helps you jump a little higher, are plentiful. I see three hovering over aisles close to me right now, but high-level power-ups, like the ability to fly for the entire game, are very rare and hard to reach. Some power-ups are so valuable that a team might send one of their players after them for the entire game. Power-ups can be worth a lot of money in the Warcross community. In regular games, unused power-ups that you collect can be stored in your player inventory. You can then sell or trade them to other players. Valuable power-ups can sell for thousands of notes. Warcross is so well-programmed that I've never tried to steal a power-up. But I recently found a security bug that might let me grab an item from a user's account right as she's about to use it. I find myself looking around us now, wondering how much I could get if I nabbed some of these items for resale. But none of the ones I can see are valuable enough. 50 notes here, another 30 there. Not worth risking a hack of the biggest opening game ever. Definitely not worth risking another strike on my record. Asher is making the first move of the game, an analyst's voice echoes in my ears. He's giving Jenna some instructions, a power-up grab. Sure enough, Asher has spotted something before anyone else has. He looks first at Jenna, then makes an arm gesture toward a distant marble hovering over a rock jutting high out of the far end of the lagoon. She doesn't hesitate. Immediately, she hops off her floating aisle and onto another one, making her way toward the rock. Behind her, the aisle she was originally standing on now crumbles into pieces.
Something's caught Ash's eye, another analyst chimes in. It takes a lot for him to send away one of his teammates.
At the same time, Asher and his fighter Max lunge forward. The other team is already on the hunt, hurtling toward them. Every time a player leaps from one aisle to another, the aisle left behind crumbles away. They must all choose their steps wisely. Asher and Max move as one, their attention focused on Penn. They're going to attack him on both sides. I crane my neck in the direction where the distant object is hovering in an attempt to see what power-up had caught Asher's eye. My world zooms in. The power-up is a marble sphere, so red it looks like it was dipped in blood.
Sudden death, an analyst exclaims, right as I gasp.
A rare power-up indeed. Sudden death can render a player of your choice frozen for the rest of the game, useless to his or her teammates. I've never seen this power-up in play during a regular Warcross match, and only a handful of times in an official tournament game. It must be worth at least $5,000, maybe $15,000. Max, for all his size, is faster than Asher. He reaches Penn first, then lunges for the red artifact over his head. Penn ducks out of the way in time. The aisle they're both standing on starts to crack, unable to support them both for long. And Penn makes a leap for the next closest aisle. But Max's hand closes around his arm before he can do it. Max lets out a roar and flings Penn backward. Penn goes flying. He manages to seize the edge of an aisle before he plummets to the lagoon below. There he dangles, momentarily helpless and dazed. The audience roars as Penn's life bar drops from Max's blow. Penn Wachowski, Team Beta, life minus 35%, 12 bars. Now Asher joins the action. He leaps off his own aisle as it crumbles, landing in a perfect crouch on the aisle Penn is clinging to. The aisle shudders from the impact. He leans down, seizes Penn by his neck before he has recovered from his last hit, and pummels him into the aisle's dirt, cracking the ground. A burst of blue light radiates out from Asher in a ring at his attack. Penn Wachowski, Team Beta, life minus 92%, warning, 3 bars. The invisible audience screams while an analyst shouts, "Penn's going to go down! If he doesn't protect his team's artifact, Asher's going to end this game early!" Pan frees one hand and unleashes a lightning power-up on Asher before he can make a fatal blow. A blinding flash of light engulfs Asher for an instant. He throws his hands up in vain, but too late. The power-up has blinded him for 5 solid seconds. His own life bar drops by 20%. Pan lunges for Asher's artifact. At the last instant, Max saves their artifact by grabbing it first, so that it now hovers over his head. The crowd lets out a roar of cheers and boos. I follow suit, but my attention keeps going back to the sudden death power-up. Don't do it.
Sharp effort from Beta. Pen's been working on his defense,
an analyst shouts over the noise. As he speaks, the storm's clouds finally reach us, and the sun disappears overhead.
We lost track of Kento for a while, but it looks like he's now hunting after Jenna. Both are going for the sudden death power-up.
Wind blasts us. It makes the floating aisles wobble in the air. Fat drops of rain start to fall, making each aisle slippery and harder to stand on. I turn my attention to Jenna and Kento, who look like two small bright figures fast approaching the power-up hovering over the rock. Then I swoop down from the aisles and fly in their direction. Soon, I am hovering near the blood-red sudden death, watching as Jenna and Kento dash for it. I focus on the power-up. In theory, if Jenna or Kento get their hands on sudden death, I might be able to hack into their player accounts. I might be able to steal sudden death right out of their account. And then I could sell it. $15,000. In spite of myself, my head spins with excitement. Could this work? Hacking into a regular Warcross game has never been done, but an official championship tournament game? Unheard of. I don't even know if I can access their accounts the same way I can in regular Warcross. My hack might not work at all. If they catch me and I'm arrested, I'll be charged as an adult. Breaking the law had only quickened my father's death. It certainly hadn't made my life any easier. I stay where I am, torn, my throat dry. What if I do successfully steal it? It's just a power-up in a game. I'm not hurting anyone. I've never tested this Warcross hack in an arena like this, but what if it works? I could resell it for thousands. I could get that money immediately and give it to Mr. Alsol, pay off my debts. It could save me. And I'd never do it again. The temptation nips at me, and I wonder if this is how my father felt every time he'd logged online to place just one more bet. Just one bet. Just this once. Jenna reaches the power-up first. She only has time to swipe it off the top of the cliff before Kento tackles her. If I don't make a decision now, it'll be too late. Instinctively, I move. My fingers tap madly against my tabletop. I bring up a player directory, then hunt for Jenna's profile. As I go, Jenna kicks Kento off her, and then dives in a perfect arc down toward the lagoon. A deafening thunderclap sounds out overhead. Jenna's name finally pops up. I have only a few seconds to act. Don't do it, but I'm already moving. A complete inventory of her virtual belongings appears. I scroll until I see the brand new sudden death item in her account, shiny and scarlet. The only weakness I've ever found in Warcross's security is a tiny glitch when a user is about to use an item. When the item passes from an account into the game and is used, there's a split second when it's vulnerable. My fingers tremble. Before me, Jenna reaches for her new sudden death power-up. In her inventory, I see it flash a quick gold. Now's my only chance. I suck in my breath. Wait. Don't do it. And then type a single command just as Jenna's item leaves her hand. A tingle shoots through my body. I freeze. In fact, everyone in the game seems to freeze. Then I notice that Asher is looking right at me. Like he can see me. I blink. That's impossible. I'm in the audience. But Jenna is staring at me, too. Their eyes are wide. That's when I realize that the sudden death power-up is now officially in my account. I see it in my inventory at the bottom of my vision. I did it. My hack worked. But somehow, successfully capturing the power-up has glitched me into the tournament. A referee's whistle echoes around us. The audience's cheers turn into whispers of shock. I stay where I am, suddenly unsure of what to do. Frantically, I type in another command, trying to go back to being part of the audience again. But it's no use. Everyone, the players, the announcers, the millions in the audience, can see me.
"Who the hell are you?"
Asher says to me. I just stare back, numb. A flash of red light engulfs the scene, and the omniscient voice echoes all around us. "Time out," it booms. "System glitch." Then, my screen goes dark. I'm kicked out of the game and back into my starting room, looking out at a virtual view of Tokyo. The doors in the room are gone now. The sudden death power-up is still glowing in my inventory. But when I reach for it, it vanishes. They've deleted it from my directory. I rip my glasses off. Then I sit back in my chair, looking wildly around our apartment. My eyes settle on Kira, seated across from me. She's taken off her glasses, too, and is staring at me with the same shocked expression I'd seen on Jenna's face.
"Em," Kira whispers. "What did you do?"
I stutter, then stop. Something about reaching into Jenna's account had erased my anonymity. I've been exposed. I stare down at the table. My heart thuds. Kira leans forward.
"I could see you in the game," she says. "Em, Asher spoke to you. He could see you. They could all see you."
She throws her hands up in astonishment.
"You glitched the game."
She has absolutely no idea how much trouble I've just gotten myself into. She thinks this was an honest mistake. Below my rising panic lies an ocean of regret. I don't know what Hanka Games does when they catch a hacker, but they'll ban me from the game for sure. I'll go to court for this.
"I'm sorry,"
I reply in a daze.
"Maybe they won't make a big deal out of it."
My voice trails off. Kira lets out a long breath and leans back in her chair. We don't speak for a while. After being so immersed in Warcross, the silence in the apartment feels overwhelming.
"You're smart, Em,"
Kira finally says, her eyes meeting mine. "But I have a feeling you're dead wrong on that one." And as if on cue, my phone rings. Chapter 5. We both jump at the sound. When I peer at the phone, the caller ID says unknown number.
"Aren't you going to answer it?"
Kira says to me, her eyes as wide as mine now. I just shake my head repeatedly at the phone. I don't move from my spot until, after what seems like an eternity, it finally stops ringing. Immediately, it rings again. Unknown number. The hairs rise on the back of my neck. I turn the phone's sound off, then throw it onto the couch so I can't see it. In the silence, I stay hunched in my chair and try not to meet Kira's bewildered stare. The caller had to be the police. Would they come to arrest me now if I didn't pick up? Would Hanka Games sue me? It occurs to me that I'd just interrupted a game watched by 500 million people, a game that accepts millions in sponsor money. Would the game studio itself put out a bounty on my head for other hunters to track me down? In fact, they could be sending out a text alert right now, and all across the city, Hunters would be swinging onto their motorcycles or hopping in cabs, eager to catch me. I press my shaking hands tightly together in my lap. I could run. I had to. I'd grab the first train and make my way out of the city until everything dies down. But I grimace immediately at the impossible thought. If I ran, where would I go? How far could I get with only $13? And if, no, when they caught me, it would just make my crime worse. It might be safer for me to stay put right here. Kira wanders over to the couch. It's still ringing, Em. Then stop looking at it. I shoot back, harsher than I'd meant to sound. She throws her hands up. Fine. Whatever. Suit yourself. Without another word, she turns away from me and heads for her mattress. I close my eyes, put my head in my hands, and lean against the table. The silence in the room is overwhelming, and even though I can't hear my phone, I can feel it. Can somehow tell that it's still ringing. At any moment, there'll be a fist pounding on our door. Every locked door has a key. But this time, I've reached the end. I don't know how long I sit like that at the table, spinning thoughts and plans until they all jumble together, or when, in my utter exhaustion, I start to nod off. I don't realize that I've fallen asleep until somewhere through the darkness, a sound stirs me. Ding. 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 I open one eye groggily. Is that my alarm going off? Sunshine streams in through the blinds of our windows. For an instant, I admire how pretty the bright light looks. In fact, it's the kind of bright light that tells me I'm late for something. A sinking feeling hits my stomach. I'd fallen asleep right at the dining table. I jerk my head up. My entire body is sore, and my arms are cramped and tingly from being slept on all night. I look around in a daze. What happened last night comes back in a rush. While Kira went to bed, I'd stayed here at the table, my head in my hands, wondering how I could have been stupid enough to reveal myself to 500 million people. I must have had nightmares last night, even though I can't remember any of them. I'm dead tired, and my heart is pounding furiously. The phone calls. The unknown caller ID. My heart seizes, and my eyes go to my phone, still lying on the couch. I'd slept for a few hours, and no one had come to our door. Some of my panic from the night before eases, and the shock of standing in the middle of the opening game dulls. Maybe nothing will actually happen. The events even feel like a dream. Ding. I turned toward the sound again. It came from my phone. Suddenly I remember that it's Wednesday. I'm late for my shift at the diner. That must be my boss texting me, and my text messages still make a sound on my phone. In a heartbeat, my worries shift from my glitch to the danger of losing the only money-making gig that I have. I leap out of my chair. Kira stirs in her corner, partially hidden from view behind the cardboard divider. I rush into the bathroom and jam a toothbrush into my mouth, running a quick comb through my tangle of rainbow hair as I go. I'm wearing the same clothes I wore last night. They'll have to do. No time to change. I curse silently at myself as I finish brushing my teeth. I'm going to get fired for missing my shift. My head bows as I lean against the sink, struggling under the weight of the world. Ding. Ding, ding. Oh, for the love of... I snap under my breath. When my phone lets out two more dings, I give up ignoring it and hurry out of the bathroom. I'm on my way, I mutter, as if my boss could hear me. I grab my phone and stare down at the long list of texts. 84 messages from a blocked number. They all say the same thing. Ms. Amika Chen. Please call 212-555-0156 immediately. An uneasy feeling settles in my stomach.
M.
I turn to see Kira out of bed and peering through the blinds. Only now do I hear the sound of voices coming from the street below.
Emmy, Kira says. Come look.
I walk to her on quiet feet. Thin slants of light cut through the blinds, painting yellow stripes against my arms. Kira's lips are folded into a puzzled frown. I pull two blinds apart and look outside. A cluster of people jams the steps leading up to our apartment complex. They have huge cameras with them. I see call letters printed on the sides of their microphones. It's the local news stations. My stomach drops. What's going on? Kira turns to face me, then fumbles in her pockets for her phone. She quickly types something. I hold my breath, listening to the buzz of voices outside. Kira reads the search results on her phone. The color has drained from her face, and her eyes are wide.
Emmy, she says, you're everywhere.
I find myself looking at a list of news articles, each one displaying the same photo. A screenshot of me, with my rainbow-colored hair, standing inside the Warcross opening game, with Asher turned toward me in shock. Kira scrolls down for me. The articles go on and on, their headlines melding together. Audience member glitches into Warcross opening game. Warcross hacked. Hacker temporarily disrupts Warcross opening. Who is Amika Chen? My mouth goes dry at the sight of my name. I'm a fool for thinking that my little stunt last night would have attracted anything less than a spotlight. My identity's been blown. Not only blown, but with those blown bits plastered all over the internet like stickers. It's too late to run. I stay frozen as Kira continues to search, her expression turning more stunned as she goes. They can't possibly be talking about me, I stammer. They can't. I must still be asleep. You're not asleep. Kira holds up her phone again. I read a feed littered with my name. You're the world's top trending topic. Over by the dining table, my phone dings again. We look at it in unison. Kira, I say, do me a favor and look up a number for me. She follows me to the dining table, where I pick up the phone and scan at the endless string of identical texts. 212-555-0156. Kira types it into a search. A second later, she swallows and looks at me. It's the number for Henka Games' Manhattan headquarters. A prickling sensation of dread travels down my spine and along my arms. Henka Games has sent me over 80 text messages. Kira and I look at each other for a moment longer, letting the commotion outside fill the silence in our room. It's probably their lawyers, I whisper. A rush of lightheadedness makes me sway in place. A flurry of thoughts flash by. Police sirens, handcuffs, courtrooms, interrogation chambers. Familiar experiences for me. Kira, they're going to sue me.
You better call them, Kira replied. It won't be any better for you if you wait.
She's right. I hesitate for a second before finally grabbing my phone. My hands are shaking so badly that I can barely dial the numbers. Kira crosses her arms, pacing in front of me.
Put it on speaker, she adds.
I do. Then hold the phone between us. I'd expected some general thank you for calling Henka Games for English Press 1 automated message, the typical greeting from a corporate number. But instead, the phone rings only once before a woman answers. Miss Amika Chen, she says. I'm so startled by her personal greeting that I fumble all over my answer.
Hi, here, I mean, me, I mean, that's me.
I wince. Why am I even surprised? Obviously, they know my phone number, judging by the text message avalanche. They must have forwarded me straight to a live operator the instant I dialed them. They've been waiting. Excellent, the woman says. I have Mr. Hideo Tanaka on the line for you. Please hold. Kira sucks in her breath and stops pacing. She looks at me with wide eyes. I stare back, paying attention to nothing but the hold music now playing on the phone. I've lost my mind. Did she just say? We both jump when the music abruptly cuts off. A man's voice comes on the line. It's a voice I'd recognize anywhere. One I've heard in countless documentaries and interviews. One that belongs to the last person I thought I'd ever talk to. Miss Chen, says Hideo Tanaka. His accent is British. Attended a British international school, I remind myself feverishly. Studied at Oxford. His voice, easy and refined, carries in it the authority of someone who runs a huge corporation. I can only stand there, phone in hand, staring at Kira as if I could see straight through her. Kira wheels her arms frantically at me, reminding me that I'm supposed to respond. I manage. Hey. A pleasure, Hideo says. And my phone trembles in my grip. Kira takes pity on me and holds it for me. I expect Hideo's next words to have something to do with my hacking incident, so I immediately start to stammer some sort of apology, as if that might help my case. Mr. Tanaka, about yesterday, look, I am really, really sorry for what happened. It was a total accident, I swear. I mean, my glasses are pretty old and they glitch a lot. I wince again. I mean, not that your stuff is badly made or anything, which it's not. That is...
Yes. Are you busy right now?
Am I busy right now? Hideo Tanaka is on the phone, asking me if I am busy right now. Kira's eyes look like they're going to pop right out of their sockets. Don't sound stupid, Amika. Be cool. Well, I reply. I'm actually late for my waitressing shift. Kira slaps her forehead with the palm of her hand. I hold both hands out at her in a panic.
I apologize for interrupting your schedule, Hideo says, as if my answer were the most natural thing in the world. But are you willing to skip work today and come to Tokyo?
My ears start to ring. What? Tokyo, Japan?
Yes.
I cringe, glad he can't see my face turning red. What did I expect him to say? Tokyo, New Jersey? Like, right now? A note of amusement enters his voice.
Yes, like right now.
My head spins. I'd love to, but my roommate and I are actually about to get evicted from our apartment tomorrow, so...
Your debts have been taken care of.
Kira and I exchange a blank look. I'm sorry, what?
I murmur.
They're taken care of?
Yes.
The calculations that run constantly through my head. Rent, bills, debt. $1,150, $3,450, $6,000. Your debts have been taken care of. Just like that, they scatter. Replaced by nothing except white noise. How can this be? If I went to Mr. Alsel's apartment right now, would he wave us away and tell us that we're good to go? Why would Hideo Tanaka do this? I suddenly feel lightheaded, like I might float right out of my body. Don't faint. They can't just be taken care of, I hear myself say. That's a lot of money.
I assure you, it was very simple, Miss Chen.
Yes. Sorry. Yes, I'm still here. Great. There is a car waiting outside your apartment, ready to take you to John F. Kennedy International Airport. Pack whatever you like. The car is ready when you are. A car? But wait. When's the flight? What airline? How much time do I have to... It's my private jet, he says unconcerned. It will take off whenever you are in it. His private jet. Wait, but all my stuff, how long will I be there? My eyes shift back to Kira. She looks pale, still processing the fact that our debts have been erased in the blink of an eye. If you'd like any belongings packed up and shipped to Tokyo with you, he replies, just say the word and it'll be done today. In the meanwhile, you will have everything you need here. Hang on. I start to shake my head. Shipping my belongings over? Just how long does he want me to stay there? My brow furrows. What I need is a sec to think. I don't understand. My emotions finally spill out, unleashing a torrent of thoughts. What's this all about? The car, my debts, the plane, Tokyo? I sputter. Yesterday, I disrupted the biggest game of the year. Someone should be angry with me. You should be. What am I going to Tokyo for? I take a deep breath. What do you want from me? There's a pause on the other end. Suddenly, I realize that I'm mouthing off to one of the world's most powerful people, to my idol, someone I've watched and read about and obsessed over for years, someone who had changed my life. Across from me, Kira watches the phone intently, as if she could see what Hideo's expression looks like. I swallow in the silence, afraid for a moment. I have a job offer for you. Hideo replies, would you like to hear more? Chapter 6 Confession. I've been on an airplane a grand total of one time. It was after Mom left, and Dad decided to move us from San Francisco to New York. What I remember of that flight is the following. A tiny TV monitor to watch cartoons on. A little window through which I could see the clouds. A Tetris-like meal tray holding something questionably called chicken. And a mod of the original Sonic the Hedgehog 2 video game loaded onto my phone. My go-to game whenever I was feeling stressed out. Somehow, I think my second flight will be very different from my first. After the call with Hideo ended, the first thing I did was rush down the hall and knock on Mr. Alsol's door. One glance at his dumbstruck face was all I needed to know that I didn't just hallucinate everything. Our rent is paid through the end of next year. I pack in a daze. I don't own a suitcase, so I end up stuffing as much clothing into my backpack as it can fit. My thoughts jumble together, every one of them about Hideo. What does he want me for? It must be huge if it means flying me like this to Tokyo. Hideo has indeed hired a few hackers in the past to help him work out bugs inside Warcross. But they were way more experienced and probably with no criminal records. What if he's actually angry with me and is waiting to dole out punishment once I'm in Japan? It's a ridiculous idea, sure, but so is being asked to pack up everything and go to Tokyo. Asked by Hideo Tanaka. The thought warms my insides again, and I tingle at the mystery of what this job offer might be. Kira's eyes trail me as I dart around the apartment. When are you going to come back? She asks, even though she'd heard the same conversation that I had. I cram another t-shirt into my backpack. Don't know, I reply. Probably soon. Secretly, I hope I'm wrong. How do you know this isn't just some huge prank? She says, a note of confusion in her voice. I mean, it was broadcast everywhere across the internet. I pause to look at her. What do you mean?
I mean,
What's to stop someone from dialing your number a million times and then playing the biggest hoax of all time on you? That must be it. It has to be. Some hacker out there thought it would be funny. Somebody broke into my phone's weak security, faked Hideo's voice, set me up. He's probably laughing his head off right now. But our rent is paid off. What prankster would waste his money like that? All I can do is shrug. Well, I'm going to see how far I can push it. Not like I have much to lose. As I finish with the last of my things, I hurry over to the little menagerie of objects by my bed. My Christmas ornament, Dad's painting. I pick up both, taking extra care with the painting. It's an explosion of blue, green, and gold streaks that, when you step back, somehow look like him holding my hand and walking me through a warm, tree-lined evening in Central Park. I stare at it for a moment longer, then pack it carefully into my bag. I could use a bit of good luck traveling with me. An hour later, I'm as ready as I'll ever be. I hoist my backpack and skateboard over my shoulders and step out of the apartment, then glance back, my eyes settling on Kira. I have a strange feeling I'm studying a life that I won't be returning to, that this will be the last time I ever see her. And I find myself softening toward her, quietly wishing her well. She'll have a rent-free apartment until the end of next year. Maybe that'll help her get back on her feet. "Hey," I say, feeling unsure of how to say goodbye. "The corner diner is going to need someone now, if you're looking." "Yeah," she smiles. "Thanks." "Good luck." She gives me a single solemn nod, like she also knows this may be permanent. "You too," she replies. Then I close the door behind me and don't look back. When I push open the building's main entrance doors, an explosion of flashing lights blinds me. I squint and throw a hand over my face. A roar of voices go up. "Miss Chen! Miss Chen! Amika!" I wonder for an instant how the hell these people recognize me, before I remember that, with the rainbow of colors in my hair, it's pretty obvious that I'm the same girl from the published screenshots. An enormous figure bounds up the steps, pushing journalists aside in the process. "Allow me, ma'am," he says in a friendly tone as he takes my backpack and board. He holds an arm out in front of me and starts making a path down the steps. When one journalist gets pushy, he shoves him back with a growl. I follow my new bodyguard dutifully, ignoring the questions thrown at me from all sides. We finally push our way over to a car, the most beautifully sleek auto car I've ever seen. I bet it's the first time one has ever been spotted on our street. The bodyguard puts my stuff in the trunk. One of the car doors opens automatically, waits for me to shuffle inside, and then closes. The sudden silence and the separation from the din outside is a relief. Everything in it looks so luxurious that I feel like I'm ruining it just by sitting here. The clean scent of a new car hangs in the space. Bottles of champagne sit in a molded block of ice. Through the windows, I can see an overlay of virtual markers over the streets and buildings. East 40th Street, reads a string of white letters overlaid across the street we're on. Colorful little text bubbles pop up over each of the buildings. Green Hills Apartment Complex. Laundromatic. Chinese food. This car has the Neuralink fully integrated into it. The car's interior lights up. A voice comes on. "Hello, Miss Chen," it says. I startle. "Hi," I say back, unsure where I should be looking. "A preference for the car mood?" the voice continues. "Something serene, perhaps." I glance out at the mob of journalists still shouting at the car's shaded windows. "Serene would be nice, Mr. Car." "Fred," the car says. "Fred," I reply, trying not to feel weird about talking to a bottle of champagne in an ice block.
Hi.
All of the windows suddenly shift, and the journalists outside are replaced with a view of a stunning landscape. Long grasses blowing in the wind, white cliffs out along the horizon, clear ocean and white foam, and a sunset tinting the clouds orange and pink. Even the chaos outside now sounds muffled, covered by calling seagulls and the crash of the virtual ocean.
I'm George, the bodyguard says as the car starts to drive us forward. You must have had quite a morning.
Yeah, I reply. So, do you know why we're heading for the airport?
My instructions from Mr. Tanaka were only to escort you safely to the jet.
I go back to staring at the virtual seascape passing us. Instructions from Hideo. Maybe it's not an elaborate prank after all. Half an hour later, the serene views on the windows fade away, and the real world comes back into view. We've arrived at the airport. Instead of pulling into the usual circle where all the other vehicles go, though, ours turns into a small looping road that takes us toward the expanse of tarmac behind the airport. Here, the car pulls into a private garage that is situated next to a small row of jets. I scoot out of the car's dark interiors, then squint in the light. I pick out the jet with Henka Games written on its side. It's enormous, nearly the size of a commercial liner, except thin and sleek, with an elegant, sharp-nosed design that distinguishes it from the other jets. The panels along the sides of the plane look strange, almost translucent. The main door is open, and a set of stairs lead down to the tarmac, where a plush red rug lies. This is the plane that Hideo himself uses whenever he travels.
This way, Miss Chen,
George says to me with a slight bow of his head. I'm about to go around to the back of the car to grab my backpack, but he stops me.
You won't need to lift anything on this trip,
he adds with a smile. I stand there awkwardly, empty-handed, as George grabs my stuff and leads me in the direction of the jet. I make my way up the steps. At the top, two flight attendants dressed in impeccable uniforms give me dazzling smiles and a bow of their heads.
Mr. Tanaka welcomes you on board,
one of them says to me. I nod back, unsure what to say to that. Is Hideo being kept up to date on where I am right now? Does he know I'm boarding his plane at this very moment? My thoughts linger on the flight attendant's words, until I turn to look at the inside of the jet. Now I understand why the outside panels of the plane looked so translucent. The interior appears lined with glass panels, through which I can see the airport, runway, and sky. On second glance, the panels have the Henka Games logo carved subtly into the surface. Sleek lines of light rim the panels. I've only ever seen the insides of planes crammed with seats, but this one has a full-length leather couch at the far end. An actual bed embedded against each side, a full bathroom and shower, and a set of soft lounge chairs near the front. A glass of champagne and a plate of fresh fruit sit on the table, separating the lounge chairs. I'm frozen for a moment, suddenly uneasy in the midst of this extravagance. George sets my backpack in a back closet of the plane. Then he gives me a tip of his hat and a smile.
Have a lovely trip, he says. Enjoy the flight.
Before I can ask him what he means, he turns away and heads down the stairs to his car. As the attendants seal the door, one of them invites me to make myself at home. I wander over to one of the lounge chairs, sink cautiously onto the soft leather, and inspect the armrests. Do these glass panels change, like the windows in the car I just rode in? I'm about to ask the attendant approaching me, but I'm interrupted when he hands me a pair of glasses. I recognize it instantly as the current generation of Warcross glasses that are being sold in stores, much more powerful than the old rentals I've been using up until now. For your enjoyment, the attendant says, smiling at me, and for a full flight experience. Thanks. I turn the glasses in my hands, admiring the solid gold metal of the arms. My fingers stop above an elegant logo that says,